today is Michael Evans versus Anthony Catalanic et al. It's appeal 06-1253. Mr. Hale.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Andrew Hale. I represent the appellants who are the police officer defendants in this case. This case concerns the rape and murder of 9-year-old Lisa Cabasa back in 1976. Michael Evans was convicted of that crime twice based on the testimony of an eyewitness who told the police that while walking home from work, she saw Evans and another male abducting Lisa Cabasa off the street. This appeal has raised several legal issues, two of which I'd like to focus on this morning.
Can you just back up and tell me about how we got into the situation that we're in today? It's very disturbing. They get one of these cases that's set for trial end of January of this year and then get a qualified immunity appeal. How long was the summary judgment motion pending in the district court? I know that Judge Kaur, long opinion here, and decided the case in the 6th of January, I believe.
Summary judgment, recollection, was fully briefed in October. The summary judgment briefs were not submitted until the close of discovery, which was extensive. There were well over 100 depositions taken. And the ruling came down, as you said, Judge Evans, on January 6th.
So we had sort of the same situation in this last case where there's a summary judgment decision that comes down shortly before the trial. I know in the district court in Wisconsin, I think generally the trial dates are not set until summary judgment motions are resolved, and that would obviate the problem that's created here where this is a big case, a lot of time set aside to try the case, and then there's this appeal and a motion to dismiss the appeal, summarily affirm. And, you know, that's hard for our motions panels to resolve issues like that so quickly, so the trial gets scuttled. Now you're here to argue qualified immunity, very limited interlocutory appeal issues. I just think it's a bad way to run a railroad, I guess.
I don't disagree, Judge Evans. The two issues, the legal issues I wanted to talk about this morning, one is abandonment, and the second one is collateral estoppel. Both those legal issues pertain to two motions that Evans brought prior to his first criminal trial. One was a motion to quash the arrest. The second was a motion to suppress the witness identification. The basis of the motion to quash the arrest was that Mr. Evans' counsel believed that the police shouldn't have relied on the eyewitness based on facts that were not in dispute. She waited 4 days to come forward. She waited 6 weeks to identify Evans by name. When she finally did identify him, that motion was denied by Judge Strayhorn after a lengthy evidentiary hearing where defendant Catalanic testified for several days.
But as you began your argument, you gave us some of the story, but what's also critical here is that the conviction was vacated. And why the conviction was vacated? And I mean, don't the equities here, particularly in light of his argument that there's newly discovered evidence, I mean, why should the collateral estoppel doctrine apply here, given the circumstances?
Well, that I was going to address that issue on the collateral estoppel argument, and we can jump ahead if you want. It's really one or the other here. He either abandoned those issues that he brought in his motion to quash and his motion to suppress identification, or he's collaterally estopped from doing so, because after the first trial,
But if the police manipulate a witness, as the allegation is here, and then that witness testifies, and the motion is resolved by a judge not knowing the underlying facts. I don't see how collateral estoppel mm-hmm. could act to prevent them from ever raising that issue.
In order to answer that question, we have to fast forward to the part of the brief where we talk about the due process claim. The plaintiffs are alleging that the witness was manipulated and certain things were done to the eyewitness that Judge Strayhorn wasn't aware of. Now we've got to look at it from a due process context. As we set forth in the briefs, taking the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, there's nothing new here in regards to any manipulation of the eyewitness that would be, first of all, nothing new, and surely nothing that would be considered material. Their whole case about manipulation is based on the same facts, they're undisputed, back at the first trial. She waited 4 days to come forward. She didn't identify him for 6 weeks. For 6 weeks, she told the police she didn't know who it was. She didn't say it was Lisa Cabasa right off the bat. Then later, she says it was three guys, not two guys. I mean, all that was known at the first trial. They don't have anything new as to manipulation.
The witness went into much greater detail about the circumstances of her detention, and all of that is new in her deposition.
The only thing that was arguably new was deposition testimony about a second detention on the day that Evans got arrested. We addressed that in the brief and said the fact that she might have gone down to the police station the day he was arrested is not a material fact showing she was manipulated. And in fact, we showed through the record how even the plaintiff admitted that the day Evans was arrested, there was a whole sting set up inside the place where Ms. Januszewski worked. That's where Ms. Januszewski was. The plaintiff walked by that morning and he was arrested. She wasn't detained all that day, couldn't have been detained all that day. She brought up nothing new in her deposition about manipulation that would support a due process claim. Their due process claim is all based on, the whole guts of that case is based on the same facts that the plaintiff knew about and everybody knew about, Judge Strayhorn and the assistant state's attorneys, back before the case was tried the first time. The point I wanted to raise on abandonment is, after the first conviction, when Evans brought a motion for a new trial, he didn't raise in that motion the denial of those two motions that were denied by Judge Strayhorn. He was granted a new trial. Second trial, he elected not to renew those motions again. Now, if those motions were final at that time, he was collaterally stopped from bringing those again. And if they weren't, he abandoned them. He elected not to raise those issues again before his second trial, which he was free to do. Now he's trying to revive those issues here, 30 years later, when he abandoned those issues back after the first trial.
Does the state of Illinois, has it ever considered some sort of legislative compensation to somebody who here was spent this ungodly amount of time in prison for something they didn't do?
Well, there is a system through the Court of Claims. The plaintiffs who are wrongfully incarcerated can apply for compensation, which the plaintiff in this case, my understanding, has done. There's a statutory mechanism on the amount you can receive based on how long you were incarcerated, and based on that, a person can apply, and the plaintiff has, and will get compensation based on the statute through the Court of Claims. And that was the purpose of trying to get an innocence pardon from the governor so that process could be undertaken. And, in fact, the plaintiff did get an innocence pardon and has applied for that compensation. I don't know if he's gotten the money yet, but he will.
But I also want to get – I'm really not following you. When his second conviction is vacated on the basis of the DNA evidence and the judge grants the motion – for a new trial. He also vacated the conviction in the first place where the rulings were made. I just don't understand why he should be precluded from raising those issues now. It's
well,
a clean slate.
There's two issues. If you look at the plaintiff's brief on this point, I think it's telling. Their whole argument about why collateral estoppel shouldn't apply in light of the conviction being vacated, both convictions, they cite a case from the Sixth Circuit, and I urge the judges to read that case, the Doddrell case, where that case, let me read you what they said. The court said, quote, the conviction was reversed on grounds having no bearing on the validity of the fact findings. The reversal, however, vacates the judgment entirely, technically leaving nothing to which we may accord preclusive effect. That is contrary to Illinois law, Illinois Supreme Court law, that we cited in our brief and that the plaintiff completely ignored in his brief. Didn't even mention the People versus Enos case where the court held a defendant's conviction, if it's reversed for trial error and the cause is remanded for a new trial, the doctrine of collateral estoppel bars the relitigation of a pretrial ruling, such as a motion to suppress.
But didn't the court in Ennis specifically recognize an exception to the collateral estoppel doctrine when the defendant offers additional evidence or there are other special circumstances?
Yes. That's part.
And so why isn't that our situation here?
Because there's no additional evidence. It's all the same facts we knew about the first go-round, and there aren't special circumstances. The special circumstances exception has been held to mean, did the party have an incentive to fully litigate the issues? And we cited the Savickas case where the party was facing a charge of murder, life in prison. The court said you surely have the opportunity, you surely have the incentive to fully litigate the pretrial motions you brought. The same thing applies here. Mr. Evans was facing basically 200 to 400 years in prison. You're darn right he had every incentive to fully litigate the motion to suppress and the motion to suppress the witness identification and quash the arrest. And in terms of additional evidence, that's what we've said all along. There's nothing new. It's based on all the same circumstantial evidence of manipulation that they thought took place that they knew about the first go-round because the witness waited 4 days to come forward and waited 6 weeks to identify the plaintiff by name. That's what this case is about.
So it's your position that the state trial judge's rulings on the suppression motions and the ID motion, the suppression motion on the arrest and the ID motion, are still good law
right
after the conviction has been vacated. I
right.
think you're overreading that Ennis case. That makes no sense to me.
Well, and then if you're talking about the pardon, is your issue the pardon or the vacation?
The convictions have been vacated. In order to get collateral estoppel, you need a good judgment. Otherwise,
well,
there's nothing to give collateral estoppel effect to. There is no good judgment.
Let's talk about the first trial first. According to the Ennis case, if a case gets reversed for trial error, you can still have collateral estoppel effect for a motion to suppress.
You're overreading that case, counsel. What that case stands for is that if the case is appealed on some other grounds and reversed for a new trial, that you don't relitigate the motions that were not appealed.
Well, I think a fair reading to that case is if the case is reversed for an issue that doesn't affect the integrity of the pretrial rulings, then those pretrial rulings should still stand. And it's our position that the fact that Ms. Januszewski, the eyewitness, received relocation money wouldn't have affected the motion to suppress the identification, which claimed police manipulation, and wouldn't have even affected the probable cause issue. I read the Enos case to
it
say...
It goes to her credibility.
Well, I don't think the fact that she got relocation money would have been sufficient as a matter of law to say the police couldn't have relied on her now. Throw her out the window.
I thought that was more reward money than relocation.
Well, it was both. She called... her first contact was to an organization.
Some hotline,
well,
or something.
Not
some
a hotline.
Reward.
To a gentleman who was part of an organization offering a reward for information about the crime. And she also received relocation expenses to move because she was receiving threats. I don't think that fact would have, there's no way that fact would have disallowed the police from relying on that eyewitness, just because of the fact that she called a person who was part of an organization offering a reward.
Well, Judge Corr's opinion said that this witness was the total linchpin of the state's case against Evans and Terry.
There's no doubt about that. She was the linchpin.
And any warts on her were material.
Well, for purposes of probable cause, you don't have to have a wartless eyewitness. I mean, there's numerous cases on that. The Beauchamp case we cite, where the rape victim waited a long time to come forward. She had a grudge against the party she was accusing of raping her. There were inconsistencies in her polygraph.
But you do have to have a witness whom the police have not manipulated.
Absolutely. And that's
the whole claim here.
Yeah, that's the point of our case. What's the evidence of manipulation? She waited 4 days to come forward. She didn't identify for 6 weeks. It's the same circumstantial evidence that they raised the first go-round that if they're not collaterally stopped from using it, they've abandoned it. They abandoned that issue about police manipulation in the motion to suppress identification. They didn't renew that the second time around.
You're asking to have it both ways, counsel. You're saying that under Illinois law, the criminal defendant here was barred from relitigating the suppression motions once he was granted a new trial, and also that he has abandoned it because he didn't do that.
I'm saying it's one or the other. If there wasn't finality for those rulings, if you say it wasn't collateral estoppel because there was no finality and you can't be held to a collateral estoppel effect, he surely abandoned those issues. At the second trial, before trial, he had every right then to renew his motion to suppress the identification claiming police manipulation, which he didn't do. He didn't do. That is the most telling thing here. Why didn't he bring that motion again before his second trial if he thought there was police manipulation?
Well, you're saying that the Ennis case barred him from doing that.
No, I'm saying the Ennis, that was related to collateral estoppel, not abandonment. I see my time is up.
You can answer Judge Sachs' question.
The Ennis case related to the collateral estoppel issue, not the abandonment issue. I think the Ennis case simply, I read it to say, if a case gets reversed, the judgment's vacated for reasons that don't affect the integrity of the pretrial rulings, you can still have collateral estoppel effect.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lovey.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Lovey. On behalf of Lock, Bowman, and Mike Canavitz, we represent Michael Evans. And summary judgment in this case, Your Honors, was properly granted. And Judge Court denied summary judgment, but he also held that this appeal borders on frivolous. And he was exactly right. This was nothing other than an appeal because they had a right to do it. It wasn't anything they legitimately thought they had a chance to win on the merits. I want to start with the point counsel made when he said that collateral estoppel shouldn't apply because there's nothing new here. And it's clear we're talking about just two completely different cases, because the case Judge Kaur decided in his 35-page opinion and the case that we've annotated in our brief, there is a whole lot new that we didn't know then that we know now. And Judge Kaur, in his discretion, said in light of everything we've learned in this discovery that we didn't know 30 years ago, there's no way collateral estoppel applies. And for a counsel to say that there's nothing new, it's a bizarre reading of the record. I'll give you some examples. Ms. Januszewski claimed at the trial that she spontaneously came up with Michael Evans' name. She had some story about threats. She said, "I just can't take it anymore, this guy. I've known him all along, the whole 6 weeks. I just hadn't told you sooner." That is not what she said at her deposition. We learned in 2005, for the first time, that she gave up Michael Evans' name in the context of being locked up a second time. Nobody ever knew that Januszewski was locked up all day a second time. Denied bathroom breaks. Denied food. Physically threatened. And Judge Kaur, on page 9 of his opinion, held, if she's going to give up a name in the context of that kind of coercive interrogation, when she's just spent 6 weeks telling the police, "I don't know a name. I'm not even sure I saw anything," that is something that the jury could have considered material. And when the whole case turns on Januszewski, that is something that's potentially exculpatory. That's the end of the matter, and they have no answer for that. To say that there's nothing new ignores that in 1976, nobody knew a single thing about this second detention. It's brand new. They did know in 1976 that she received money, but nobody knew in 1976 she received money in the same conversation when she finally agreed to give them a name. She insists to this day she never talked about money with the police, and that only came up much after the fact. A sergeant admitted in discovery in this case that he walked into the room, they talked about paying her $1,200, which was, you know, more money in 1976 than it is now, and that's when she gave them the name. That would have been fertile cross-examination. It was not known. Another fact that was not known is she didn't spontaneously give up Michael Evans' name. I mean, the story she told at trial was, "I've been keeping it in, I knew all along, and I'm just too scared, now I have to say the name." She admitted at her deposition they were asking her names, and that's the context that she gave them Michael Evans' name. When they said in the context of, "Listen, we can give you some money, and it's a coercive environment, was it Michael Evans?" That's when she said Michael Evans. Again, that's new information. It's something that could have cross-examined her. She told them that she lied to them. She told them that repeatedly. And she says she no longer can remember what she lied about. She says that she could, at her deposition, she said, from what she could see and perceive, the police could tell that she was lying. And she also said that she told the police, "I don't want to testify. What I saw is not enough." She says this at her deposition. Of course, at trial, she got up there and insisted that she saw Michael Evans from 10 feet away. At her deposition, she tells a different story. She says, I told the police I didn't see enough. Don't make me testify. And they told her that they had to. And they lied to her, and they tricked her, and they got her to testify. She's telling a very different story in 2005. This, there is new evidence, and Judge Corr, in his discretion, properly found that in light of what we now know that we didn't know then, we're not going to apply collateral estoppel. And I haven't even gotten to Harry Januszewski. That was a big part of the district court's opinion. He said, we now know, which we didn't know then, that Januszewski's husband was trying to tell the prosecutors that she's a liar, that she didn't see what she said she saw, that she doesn't see well without her glasses, that she had spent far more time with the police than the police had and was acknowledged at trial. When Harry tried to tell the prosecutors, they locked Harry in a room. That wasn't known in 1976.
Well, did he also try to tell the lead detectives that?
He did. And they said, Harry, don't worry about it. We got it covered. And then when he tried to tell the prosecutors, they locked him in a room. That's not disputed. Harry said it in discovery. The police officers didn't deny it. In fact, when the police officers were asked, did you intentionally mislead the prosecutors on this point, they said, I take the fifth. A truthful answer could incriminate me. I'm not going to deny that. You got the Cabasas. Same thing with
Jim. On that taking the fifth thing, is there some other investigation or some other matters that are going on? I know, didn't one of the officers who took the fifth ask to be deposed because he was not going to invoke the fifth?
He did, Your Honor, and nobody knows why they took the fifth because they can't tell you. All they say is we take the fifth on everything. But there is right now an ongoing probe of a whole bunch of misconduct in Area 2 at exactly this time where coercive interrogations were going on and the police were committing some very, very bad acts, and the prosecutors are looking at it.
Are there any other police officers in this case who have taken the fifth who have now filed statements that they want to be redeposed?
No. One.
Just
the one.
Cadillac?
His name's Cadillac.
Cadillac.
And, of course, whatever it was that, at some point in time, when he was asked, did you manipulate Januszewski with the intent of depriving Michael Evans of a fair trial, he said, I'm not going to answer that question on the grounds I took the fifth. He may have other things going on. You know, we don't know what's in his mind. That's between him and his lawyers. But you guys are the judges, and you're faced with a record now where he was asked, did you railroad Michael Evans? And he says, I'm not going to deny that because if I gave you a truthful answer, it could incriminate me. That's the record before Your Honors. That's not the stuff of the qualified immunity appeal. You can't at the same time say, I'm not going to answer any questions about whether I railroaded Michael Evans and then say, hey, fine, I acted in good faith. That's not going to apply.
Can you also just tell me what the status of Mr. Terry's situation is?
He has a parallel case going in state court. It isn't as far along as this one. It's in state court.
Okay. Same defendants?
Same defendants, largely. He's the co-defendant. It's a similar fact pattern.
Did the state court apply collateral estoppel?
They haven't to date, that's for sure. All right, Your Honors, I'd like to talk now about this collateral estoppel argument, and we don't need to go any further than Judge Corr's finding that under these totality of the circumstances, this equitable doctrine just doesn't fit here. But I want to keep arguing because I got more time.
Go for it.
You know, what is it they're trying...
Brian, cut his time down.
What is it they're trying to hold us to? A pretrial suppression where Judge Strayhorn said, I'm going to deny without prejudice your attempt to suppress this. In other words, the effect of that ruling is you're free to re-argue it. And when Judge Strayhorn himself learned that the predicate for his pretrial ruling was wrong, he vacated it himself. The only thing they're falling back on is this abandonment argument, and I have several responses. First of all, Mr. Evans didn't abandon anything. After he lost the pretrial suppression ruling, he raised it again. He raised it at the trial. He said, it's not me. You got a bad ID. You got the wrong guy. He raised it in his post-trial motion, and he won. And then he made the same argument at the second trial. It's not me. You got the wrong guy. It's a bad ID. He argued it in his direct appeal. It was a sufficiency of the evidence appeal. The issue that they're saying he abandoned is exactly what he appealed. And ultimately, he won. There's no collateral estoppel when you vacate both convictions. Ultimately, when he's citing the Enos case, what counsel is doing is he's misunderstanding. Maybe this will answer the conundrum that you were alluding to, Judge Sykes. He's misconstruing the law of the case doctrine. It is certainly true that in a vertical case, if you go on appeal and don't raise arguments, you've waived them for that case. And that's the fact pattern of Enos and Enoch and the Ionko case that they cited. But that's not the same thing as saying a litigant is collaterally estopped in a different case. where issues were not raised or pursued for strategic reasons in the first case.
And the Illinois Supreme Court's use of the term collateral estoppel in People versus Enos was a complete misspeaking on the part of the court.
Exactly.
It's not a collateral case. It was the same case, and they just made a mistake.
You know, when we were moot courting, we said, should we actually say the Supreme Court misunderstood the term? And it sounds a little awkward, they did it.
Happens sometimes.
The Enos case also talks about an exception where there's other evidence, and of course, we've already talked about why that applies here. Even if I was wrong about everything I've said about collateral estoppel, they've still got two other insurmountable problems. First of all, you got the pardon. The offense has been pardoned, and not only that, but what wasn't true at the time of the briefing that now is true that Your Honors can take judicial notice of, he's received an expungement. So the innocence pardon, predicated specifically on innocence, pursuant to the statute, permits the Illinois courts to obliterate the conviction.
And so we've got a conviction that has been vacated twice, pardoned, and expunged.
Yeah, it's like a conviction that's been stomped on, mushed around, and they're trying to get a pretrial suppression ruling that was denied without prejudice, and they're saying that forever bars everything forevermore. It's not and I think the reason they're making that untenable legal argument is because they're desperate to turn this into a legal appeal. They can't just get up here and say the facts don't support qualified immunity, or we'd be back at trial, and they never would have got out of the trial. So they want to say, let's talk about this as a legal appeal, and we'll throw around words like collateral estoppel and talk about cases. That's what's really going on here. There's no merit to it. And even if we were totally wrong about everything else, let's not forget the no transcript. The pretrial suppression ruling by Judge Strayhorn, we don't know what he held. So they're trying to hold us to a ruling, and collateral estoppel is very clear. They have the burden to show, by clear and convincingly, what was decided. Judge Strayhorn may have said, all right, I've heard the testimony. This is going to be a bench trial. Let's take it up at the bench trial. Motion denied without prejudice. He might have said that. We don't know. He might have said, I don't like the font in this motion, or it's too long. We're going to take it up at trial, denied without prejudice. We just simply don't know. And under those circumstances, collateral estoppel doesn't apply. Judge Kaur spent a lot of time on this opinion. He wrote a 35-page opinion that is legally sound, and there's no reason to disturb it. Thank you, Your Honors.
Let me start off with the Fifth Amendment, Judge Evans. As counsel is full aware, there's been a long-going special prosecutor investigation for conduct at Area 2 involving John Burge. That postdates this case. John Burge wasn't around in Area 2 when this case was around. That's why the officers have taken the Fifth, as counsel well knows. And when that special prosecutor investigation concludes, I fully expect most, if not all, the officers in our case will take the Fifth. What's interesting is that after Mr. Catalink said, I now want to testify, the plaintiffs, who apparently are seeking the truth, opposed that and said he shouldn't be able to testify on his own behalf and still opposed that. Mr. Catalink hasn't testified yet. The plaintiff has a lot of answers today.
I can't fault him for that. I'd rather go to trial with them taking the Fifth.
The plaintiff has a lot of answers today on abandonment, the Enos case, the Ianco case. I think what we can't lose sight of, they had an opportunity in a lengthy brief before this court to address all those issues. And what did they do? The plaintiff completely ignored, and I say completely ignored, discussing abandonment. And under Seventh Circuit law, they've conceded the point, rightly or wrongly, under the Cincinnati insurance case we cited by Judge Posner.
Right. What about all those new facts? What can you do with that? All those new facts that came out in the deposition.
Can I get to that in a second? The abandonment issue, though, I think they have conceded the point by not addressing it in their brief, or the Enos case, or the Ianco case.
And I guess my point is, do they really need to do that in light of the fact that there are all these new facts that came out in the deposition? You agree those are all new facts?
I think they do. If they abandon the claim, they abandon the claim. But let's talk about the new facts.
Because I'm not buying your abandonment at all.
All right.
Two vacations. I mean, just what Judge Sykes pointed out, pardon and expungement.
The new facts, I urge the judges to go back to our reply brief at pages 15 through 19, and we talk about these at length. Harry Januszewski, they forfeited. They didn't even raise Harry Januszewski in opposition to summary judgment, so they can't raise him now. He's out of the picture. Judy Januszewski, the things they raise, the police brought up Michael Evans' name. Let's assume that's true. The fact that the police brought up names to the eyewitness doesn't mean they manipulated her.
Reply brief. You have a spin on it, but nonetheless, this is new information that's come out.
Well, right, it's new information.
You have a different spin, but that doesn't mean it's precluded.
I don't think it's a different spin. If you would just accept it as true, the police gave her some names, including Michael Evans. That's now a material fact that supports a due process claim? I don't think so. And we go through the other things they say in their brief about they discuss relocation expenses with her during the same conversation when she identified Evans. Let's assume that's true. So what? This is a witness they know is scared, reluctant to come forward. It would not be surprising that they discuss relocation expenses with her. They lied to her and told her there were other witnesses. So what? We cited case law that says the police can lie. They can mislead. There was nothing wrong with that. At the end of the day, their new facts are not sufficient to be, they're not material to support a due process claim. I see my time is up.
It was up a little while ago.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
All right. This case will be taken under advisement.